Steven, I run into a thing where I don't really know how much people want or like hearing about the behind the scenes of making a podcast. Number one, it's not as glamorous as like making a television show or a movie or opening a restaurant or something like that.
That's the eye of the beholder.
I suppose that's true.
Embrace your inner parasocial pal. You need to really, really dig down and realize that somewhere out there is someone who's willing to listen to the nonsense that goes on, building the nonsense we actually put on this show.
The
So you're
meta
a little worried about.
nonsense.
I'm so excited about what we're about to tell everyone and
Okay.
how either prescient or stupid or both the editorial brain trust at Phantom Island is.
So let's set it up and just walk through what happened here. The episode you're going to hear, listener, the episode that we had planned for this topic in its entirety, like maybe with some normal edits, is what I would say. But it falls upon us to do this intro first. First of all, welcome to Phantom Island. Second of all, it's presented by Homefield. Third, he's Stephen Godfrey. I'm Ryan Nanny. This is an episode that we tried to can before Christmas to sort of say, okay, we both have stuff going on. You were traveling. Let's sort of figure out some topics that we want to get a hold of. And we spent like a week sort of saying, like, all right, we're gonna and a lot of these episodes have already gone out into the world. This is one that has not. Because a thing happened. We decided, I'm not gonna over the episode itself will explain a lot of
Can I
this,
handle this
but
part?
if we want to, yeah.
Okay, you're such a rule follower. Ooh, how many times did you remind the teacher that they didn't assign homework?
I wasn't that kind. I'm not
Okay,
a snitch. It's
all
there's a
right.
difference between being a rule follower
But
and
you were definitely
snitch.
like, I don't know if she had said that we should turn this in on Monday, so I'm gonna be ready just in
I
case.
th this is the kind of person I was. I was going to parties in high school where people were drinking underage, but I was not drinking. But I wasn't tattling.
I didn't say you were tattling. I'm just
I wasn't
saying
running and
like,
telling people.
right, but okay. First off, the cardinal sin we committed here, in the
Yeah.
interest of dirtbag logic and someone who got kicked out of college, was we were too prepared. Okay, if there's a crime here, it was doing too much of our jobs. I'm gonna be
Okay,
real.
gotcha.
All right. The only thing I need to ask you, only because I can't remember, I think we recorded this. What you're about to hear, we recorded. I think it was like December 18th,
17th, December
17th. Nailed it.
17th.
All
So
right. Okay.
roughly 2 months before this comes out is
Yes. All
when
right.
we recorded it.
And today, this bumper is February 16th. And the reason we have to time stamp all this stuff is because we got a little ahead of our skis, Winter Olympics. And we came up with, it was my idea, we came up with a good show based off of a single image. And I'm not going to like recap the whole show because you're about to hear
Sure,
it.
you're about to hear it.
All
That's
right.
right.
But it's sort of centered around one team being bad, and that
The Buffalo
team
Sabres.
of the National Hockey League,
Yeah.
the old Buffalo Hockey Playing Sabres of the North American Hockey League. Okay, I think that's what the N stands for. Don't worry about it. The problem is, if you pay attention to the ice hockey at all, that was 60 days ago, and them sumbitches have caught fire.
Do you know what the Sabres have done since we recorded this episode?
They won a lot of hockey games.
Do you know what their record is since we recorded? I'll tell you this. They've
Okay.
played 25 games
Since we
since we
recorded this.
recorded this.
All right,
How
okay.
many of those do you think they've won?
Like 20 or something.
It's 18. They're 18, 5, and 2. When
Okay.
we recorded, just to give everybody a sense of what was happening, when we recorded this and we say it on the episode, they were 14, 14, and 4. They
Yeah.
had 32 points and they were last in the East. They were behind Columbus. They were behind Ottawa. They
All of the
were,
East, not their
yes,
division,
not
but
their
they were
division,
the
the
worst
entire
team in the East.
conference.
Yeah.
That's
Okay.
right. They are now tied for fifth in the East and they are only 8 points behind first place, which is at the time we record this, being shared between Tampa and Carolina. They have jumped, they have pulled their asses out of the fire. In an incomprehensible way for a team that didn't get off to a good start, but did, again, as we mentioned on this episode, we just didn't think it was going to matter
Yeah,
this
okay,
much,
but counselor,
had fired their GM.
we committed no crime other than
Okay.
saying something sucked, and now it
Yeah.
sucks marginally less. So I'm very like, okay, Ryan came in after the holiday. Yeah. Or no, it was after the national championship, which is just sort of like, if you follow this show, like, we're college football centric, and like, our year doesn't really begin until the college football season ends. So it's like a month ago or something.
Yeah.
And he was like, what are we going to do about that Sabres episode? And I was like, what are we going to do? Let me tell you what we're going to do. What we're going to do is we're about to play you the original recording from December. And then if you would like to pay us in a sort of like legally gray way of like, do you remember Miss Cleo? Like we're
I don't know that that's the comparison. No.
I think we're exactly right on, which is some sort of, maybe we go out there and file for like a religious exempt status. We can, through some sort of dark magic, will a woebegone franchise into respectability by simply doing research and saying that's a woebegone franchise.
Listen, I have more recent proof of this. If you aren't a subscriber at phantomisland.show, you haven't heard the most recent subscriber only episode that we put out, but it was about All-Star games. Since we put that episode out, the NBA played an All-Star game under a revamped format, and by and large, people are like, oh, that was good. The All-Star game, like, not, you know, still has some things we got to smooth out, but like, yeah, Victor Wembanyama was super pissed to lose, and everybody, like, people were trying. This so, yeah, great. I think we can shape reality by being wrong.
You pay us a lot. We say something is shitty.
Yeah.
Said shitty item is no longer shitty.
This offer does not apply to the Atlanta Falcons. We can't. Our magic has
No. I can't use the magic on myself. No. Like, it would, that's where you start opening. Like, if you've seen Event Horizon, that's how the wormhole opens.
That's
little
right.
Did you know? So we're gonna run you through this show, and it stands on its merits. The Buffalo Sabres have sucked ass for a good long run of time. There's a reason why. We're gonna get into the show, and then we're gonna come back and talk about maybe we have opened some sort of sports wormhole because other things happened in the sports city of Buffalo, New York, in between the original recording. So all right, let's do this. Don't worry about it. You're not in trouble, Ryan. Okay. If anything, we shouldn't plan ahead and we shouldn't be organized. These are the lessons I'm taking today. Okay.
Good to know.
All right. And then we're going to run the show. We're going to have a special guest. We'll get to her in a second. All right. And then we'll come back and we'll talk about it. Okay.
Okay.
Every rustle in the trees, a potential snare. Close my eyes and block my ears. Cut the cord.
Welcome to Phantom Island. My name is Stephen Godfrey. Ryan Nanny. One, we're brought to you by Homefield. Two, as we record this, Indiana Hoosiers are number one in college football.
Yeah, I'm going to the Rose Bowl, baby.
Legally required to mention it.
I'm going
to
tell you all about how awesome the Rose Bowl was afterwards, too.
It's good weather. Or you could just not live in Iowa. One of those two choices,
wow.
Folks. I'm going to do a real stupid podcast thing today to ask a question for Phantom Island.
Okay.
I'm going to rely on a visual in an audio-only medium.
That's fine.
Okay. I want to take you to the confines of Blue Sky, the social media platform, October 12th, 2025. I saw something that I instantly couldn't shake because the person observing a thing couldn't shake it as well.
Okay.
Friend of the program, Victoria Zeller, author of One of the Boys. Go out.
Critically acclaimed. Like, a bunch, not just even like.
I'm going to make her pissed off, but I'm going to make her uncomfortable right now.
Yeah.
So, Ryan, as you know, I summer in upstate New York. I was in four different bookstores.
Yeah.
In the Vermont, New York area this summer.
Okay.
All four of them had the book.
Yeah.
Two of them had it in like a featured section.
Yeah, sure.
Would they prop it up
yes. So you can see it? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, hey, check this out.
Right.
One was in a collection of sports books.
Mm-hmm.
And then one was just in a fiction section.
Sure.
In a town, Cambridge, I think, is the tiny little town where it has a bookstore. We always stop there.
Yeah.
But yes, go if you haven't for whatever reason, I'll forgive you. Go just buy One of the Boys.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Okay. Victoria is from, I don't know if she's from Buffalo specifically or just the Buffalo area. It doesn't really matter.
Victoria is of Buffalo. Let's put it that way.
of Western New York.
Yeah.
This is the following message from October 12th. Have been thinking about it. We're recording this in late December.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking about it that long.
Okay.
Victoria writes, this graph is going around on Twitter. It stopped me dead in my tracks. I am going to punch something. The graph, which you identified, started in a Reddit thread. Is that correct?
Yeah, we can give credit for it. So
where did
it
start?
In the Sabres Reddit, r/Sabres.
Okay.
User ugluck4242 said that actually this user is not even a Sabres fan. He says okay. he or she is a Habs fan. And
did you say Avs or Habs?
Habs.
Okay, Canadian.
Yes. Yes.
Les Habitants.
Les Habitants. Created this chart that could sort of say like what your cumulative performance looks like over time. So what that means, we're going to spell it out a little bit here. Because
hang on, you can't one, today's show is sort of about the Buffalo Sabres, the NHL team.
Yes.
Two, it is about the visual representation of
success and failure.
I was going to go with total mismanagement.
Okay, sure.
And today's question is, have I personally found something worse than just cheering for a bad team? Is there something worse than cheering for a bad team? Because
this is a Stephen Godfrey special, man.
Well, again, this is why Victoria just fired this off. I saw it on a scroll doing God knows what in the depths of college football season.
And we have sort of batted it around since then.
We've talked about it internally.
We are going to hear from Victoria later in this episode.
We are. We are. Because I would much rather a native and a Sabres fan explain this graph.
Someone who feels these feelings.
Yeah. It definitely got me. I am a fan of the NHL. And when I want to be really clear about something. I'm not a fan of Major League Baseball.
Okay.
I'm not a fan of the NFL.
Okay.
And I know so little about basketball, I think that it goes without saying.
Sure.
I got into the NHL totally of my own curiosity. So every team is interesting to me, and there's some I like, some I don't.
You like the dynamic of the league.
I just thought it was the purest thing, and I hope people out there can connect with this, where like, I don't know, did you kind of get into the Lightning growing up in Tampa?
A little bit, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But you also, like, you grew up in Tampa, Florida.
Sure.
You didn't have, like, a hockey connection in your family, right?
No.
Okay,
no.
So,
and
right.
Yeah, no.
So I am the son of, like proper Southerners, deep South Southerners.
Right.
Had no interest, didn't give a shit about hockey, as evidenced by Atlanta's success with hockey three times over. Maybe four. And I just fell in love with, like, NHL 94 and the logos. And I got a elementary or middle school subscription to the Sporting News, and they covered a ton of hockey, and the logos were cool, and I wanted a hockey jersey and all this kind of stuff. Before we go any further, in my brain, I just always thought the Buffalo Sabres were the Buffalo Sabres of Dominic Hasek in the year that they went to the Stanley Cup.
Okay.
As
this
in,
this is who they are for you.
As a casual, I talk a lot about this with your alma mater, the University of Florida.
Okay,
like when I got into college football, the coolest
thing.
You're
talking about like an imprinting.
Absolutely.
Happens.
We all start from our very first sort of like embrace of some of whatever it is, pop culture, sports, you know, politics, whatever. And when I got into like being interested in hockey before Hasek and the Sabres went to the finals, but I also, again, as like, this is just my ignorance as like a proper Southerner, I'm like, oh, Buffalo. Buffalo is like where hockey is played.
Sure.
You can play hockey outdoors in Buffalo, and it's Western New York, and all we ever hear about is the snow vis-a-vis like all the Buffalo Bills stuff.
Yeah.
We'll talk a little bit about the Bills here.
Yeah.
But this graph, I now have to describe it,
because
people are in their cars right now being like, damn it, get to it.
So let me say what this graph is, what this is measuring first.
You describe the structure of the graph, and then I'm going to try and do it a little more writery.
Descriptively?
Pretentiously.
Okay. This is a graph that tracks, in this case, the Buffalo Sabres franchise record as it evolves over time. So for each year, it is telling you not what the Sabres record was that year, but how their overall lifetime record changed year over year.
XY axis.
Yes. So on the vertical axis, we have the games above or below 500. There is a tweak in here about hockey that maybe we'll get to, maybe we won't. It's not that crucial, really.
Like tying and stuff?
Which is about like how and overtime losses and things. Like hockey has changed a little bit in that regard. Anyway. And then on the horizontal axis, we just have time. So the Sabres start in 1971, and I will say, like, it takes, I'll let you get to the meat of the graph, but But the very little beginning of this graph shows that it took about 4 years for the Sabres to get to a 500 record as a franchise.
Yeah, so the graph starts with a little bit of a dip under
normal, with what I would call like normal expansion franchise struggle.
And the horizontal is the x-axis.
I can I think that's right. Yeah.
Please, I'm the idiot who got.
Well, I didn't know we had to call them X and Y. It's fine.
Okay. And in this, there's a little dip in the beginning that's yellow because that's one of the team's basic colors of the year. Then, Ryan, describe how the line goes so far up.
Okay. So if you have ever used a cycling machine or a treadmill or something like that where you can adjust elevation.
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
Or do like a course. This looks like a hard cycling course where it's like, cool, little easy warm up for you here. And now we are going to like really amp up the difficulty. You are going to be like pedaling uphill a lot, a lot, a lot.
Because after the, starting in the late 70s, the Buffalo Sabres start kicking ass.
They start getting good. They start getting good over a long period of time. Now, again, because this is just talking about cumulative record, it is not purely straight up. There are years where that franchise total goes down.
A little bit.
But in terms of like, well, one thing that happens with this graph is the further along you get on the x-axis, the harder it is for any season to bring it up or down because you have just more accumulated mass that's already in your history at this point. So,
So,
but yes, you see sort of like a pretty, it kind of looks like a successful stock, a really successful stock.
It looks like, and I'm going to kind of spoil today's show.
Yeah.
This looks like a tiny little yellow lake.
Yeah.
A tiny little yellow lake for the first couple years that the Buffalo Sabres exist.
Yeah. In front and of then, a beautiful mountain.
And then a giant mountain range, except Ryan. And then it peaks in terms of historical winning percentage.
On November 11th.
November 11th, 2011.
Yeah.
They are 276 games above 500.
Yes.
On this graph, which goes all the way to 2025, they are now about... And it's hard because it's like it's a line graph.
At the time this like graph 50? Was at the time this graph was made. How many years this covers?
Yeah, because no. Because if I tell the listener right now who can't see this graph, God knows we'll put it out on social when we do this.
Yeah,
a mountain range has to have an arc.
It goes up
up and down
like
on both sides.
It's like a bell curve.
Today's show is that the Buffalo Sabres have basically for the majority of their existence, because they're in Buffalo fucking New York. This is the thing that just like stuck in my brain. Like you think hockey, you think people in the community who play hockey, you can spit across the lake and see Canada. This is a hockey town. And the Buffalo Sabres accordingly become a good hockey team for years and years and years. And they peak in terms of overall quality just by wins.
Yes.
As a franchise in November of 2011.
Yeah.
And then they collapse, Ryan.
Pretty quickly after that, yeah.
And it's not just losing seasons. This is what strikes me as why I'm stuck on this and why we're doing the show today. The Buffalo Sabres start losing so much that this line graph is dedicated to your all-time win-loss.
Right.
And how many games above 500 you are.
Right.
They wipe out almost all of their goodwill. Almost all of their achievement by this metric is wiped completely out from November of 2011
till
basically
today.
To present day.
Yes. For the record, as we record this, the Sabres are 14-14 with 4 overtime losses. So they basically have a 500 record right now. And the time period that we're talking about, so it's the 98-99 team that goes to the Stanley Cup final. They go to the they are regularly in the playoffs, I would say, around this time for the 10 years before that and roughly the 10 years after that. Not all of the time. There are some bad years in there, but they make a couple of conference finals in 06 and 07. And in the 2010-2011 postseason that we're talking about, they make it to the conference quarterfinals.
Okay, Ryan.
They have not been back to the postseason since then.
It sounds like you're giving a history lesson.
A little bit,
and we've got someone who's going to give us a history lesson. But first, how about some modern-day history and the history being made by our friends at Homefield?
This episode of Phantom Island is brought to you by Homefield. We usually talk about the wide, beautiful variety of college apparel Homefield has to offer, and it's all still there. Don't fret. But today, I want to talk about the recent American Basketball Association drop, because you guys, we're talking immaculate 60s and 70s retro looks, a wide variety of teams from the Pittsburgh Condors to the Minnesota Muskies to the Miami Floridians, and a ton of beautiful colors in the comfortable t-shirts and hoodies you have already come to love from Homefield. But where this collection really excites me is how much it expands our universe of animals and objects dribbling basketballs. We have a rocket you would launch to the moon, hunched over, dribbling a basketball despite not having a waist. We have an acorn happily dribbling a basketball. We have a condor wearing a crown, dribbling a basketball on top of the Civic Arena in Pittsburgh. That is not safe, and it is not within the boundaries of the court, but it doesn't matter because just like Homefield, these non-human creatures, they just love basketball. Check them all out at homefieldapparel.com, and let's get back to the episode.
Okay, I started researching this episode and falling down all type of Pegula and Eichel-shaped holes of despair on the Buffalo Sabres.
Yeah.
While I was doing this, I told Victoria, we're making an episode out of this for sure.
Right.
And Victoria and I are actually talking about another episode in the future of Phantom Island for something completely unrelated.
Yeah, this is the thing. Like, if you're just like, I have an idea for a thing these two
and you know
talk
us
about,
at all, even a little bit.
Hell, you could just email us.
Yes, please do. Godfrey at Falconscott. Was it Godfrey?
Falconscottproductions.com.
Yeah. Yeah, Godfrey at Falconscottproductions.com.
Yeah. We love learning. Like, I think one of the fundamental premises of this show is we're not that smart.
Fuck no. No. The whole point of this is I just ask a question, and we have a clearance rate of answering the question of, like, maybe 45% on the show.
That's right.
Okay. So as I started to build out the episode history for, like, the Buffalo Sabres rise and then tragedy, a little bit of disclosure here. We both worked at Secret Base at Vox Media. Still going, still a thing. Secret Base has a video series. Did you ever write an episode of Collapse? I did.
No, I don't think I have actually written any collapses.
Okay, really fun. Just really, really funny. This is funny, and I'm allowed to tell a story because it's about me.
Yeah.
I've written 1.6 episodes of Collapse.
What's the one?
When I got moved over to Secret Base after Banner Society got killed, I, like, Will Bukema and Seth Rosenthal, the whole team over there, they kind of, like, kind of handheld me as the new member of the team of the different show formats they have.
Yes.
Right? So they have Beef History, which is about two parties basically just disagreeing in public.
Yes.
And then they have Rewinder, which is like, here's a big sports moment you remember. Here's everything that led up to that.
Here's the context behind it. Yep.
And then finally, I got assigned to Collapse, and it was the Chicago Blackhawks.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I remember
this one. And again, casual hockey fan. And what I learned, it took me something like 3 months to get that video done in between other projects because I'm a casual hockey fan. I'm not a casual. So my college football knowledge right now, and the same could be said for you, is we could fill out an outline for a 15-20 minute video on YouTube, probably off of the dome.
Sure. If you were just like, why isn't USC playing for national championships
exactly
anymore?
Ryan,
like, okay,
and I,
without looking, I can give you 10 reasons why.
One of our walls in our office is a whiteboard. We could just get that done, Goodwill hunting style. Mm-hmm. Right. I am not that good at hockey, and it took me forever, but it was really rewarding when it got done to try and tell the story of. But when I said collapse, it's basically you start at a championship level
or a
moment of inarguable success for a franchise, and then you chronicle the what, the why, the how of that
how
franchise falling apart.
Yeah.
And so I did, like, the Kane Taves Blackhawks.
Oh, yeah. There's, and that is a, like,
dirty,
complicated
dirty,
story in
nasty,
a lot of ways.
Bad shit.
A lot. Some collapses, for reference, are like, this team was mismanaged, or people got hurt, or people just stopped getting along, whatever. Like, the Dallas Cowboys one is pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, Jerry Jones didn't like that Jimmy Johnson wanted credit for his work, and so, you know, but anyway, the one you're talking about, what's the .6, though? I don't know the .6.
Yeah, you do.
Is it a Falcons collapse?
No.
It can't be.
It's what I was working on when I got laid off by Vox.
I don't remember what it was.
The Atlanta Braves.
Okay.
And you know what? The benefit of this was I was like 2/3 of the way done with the script when I got clipped at Vox before Phantom Island existed. And it was really, really, really informative. And what I learned was, like, I thought I knew the history of, like, and basically it was the Atlanta Braves that won the World Series in 95. They went to all the World Series in the 90s.
Yep.
And then eventually sort of stumbled all the way into sub 500 seasons, like, and a gully before Liberty Media buys them and returns them to what we have today, which is more of a real estate story. And it was really, really informative. But this is hard work. This is like an intense amount of research. And so I felt a little queasy about telling someone else's story for today's episode. And I started pulling together the research, and I'm hitting all the, what I believe are the high marks of the Sabres. I did let Victoria know, hey, I'm doing this. We want your voice in this. You're a Sabres fan.
Yeah.
And because great writers write, mm-hmm. Victoria has provided us a guest track on the album.
An epistle of sorts. Yeah.
So we're going to play that now.
Hello, everyone. This is Victoria Zeller, author of One of the Boys and internet shit poster of some renown. More relevant to today's conversation, though, I'm a Buffalo Sabres fan, and a couple months ago, I posted this graph that shows the Sabres all-time record, kind of the upward trajectory and the plateau and then the descent, and I've been asked by Ryan and Steven to talk a little bit about the history of the team and how we got here. I guess apologies for what I'm about to do, but here's like a very abridged version, I think. I'm going to try and tell the story of the Sabres in like 5 minutes or less. We'll see how we do. So the Sabres are an expansion franchise into the NHL in 1970. They're kind of dance partnered with the Vancouver Canucks. And after a few shaky seasons to start off, they make the Stanley Cup Finals in their fifth season in the league. So that's pretty sick. These early years are kind of defined by the famous forward line known as the French Connection, Gilbert Perreault, Rick Martin, and René Robert. And the Sabres are kind of immediately relevant as a team that's in the playoffs like all the time. And they kind of ride this momentum for the entire century. They make the playoffs in 25 of their first 31 seasons, which making the playoffs is like a little bit easier for a lot of that time, but still it's pretty nuts. Most of these were not like super long or sustained playoff runs, not a lot of like President's Trophies in there. And coaches were like kind of constantly coming in and out. But the Sabres were always pretty competitive and like relevant. They were always around. And they're also like lots of Hall of Famers in this era. The aforementioned Perreault, Pat LaFontaine, Phil Housley, Dave Anderchuk, and probably most famously Dominic Hasek. So yeah, I would say in this period, the Sabres are not the class of the NHL, but they're always there. So what ends up changing into the like mid to late 90s is ownership. From 1970 until his passing in 96, the team's owned by Seymour H. Knox and his family. But the finances get really bad, like bad enough that the team almost misses payroll in December 97. We're just losing money like crazy. So the team gets sold to Jim Riggis, the owner of Adelphia. Who gets indicted for bank and securities fraud 4 years later in 2002 for $2 billion of embezzlement. Is that good? So the league takes control of the team in this era, and the next couple of years are really like scary and bad for the Sabres. Relocation and just straight up folding are on the table, which I can't even think of the last time that a like big four sports team ever folded. That's wild. But anyway, the team gets bailed out, is sold to Tom Golisano and Larry Quinn in 2003. Things are not smooth under the Golisano ownership, but the team stays like relevant on the ice. They have a really impressive pair of seasons in 05-06 and 06-07, but Tom Golisano is not interested in doing this forever. So he wants out pretty quick. So here's where our antagonist takes the stage. Terry Pegula is a lifelong Sabres fan, hockey fan, billionaire, and fracking piece of shit from Pennsylvania who kind of comes in out of nowhere in late 2010. His whole deal is he's promising to keep the team in Buffalo, and most of the other people who were trying to purchase the team from Golisano were not looking to do that. So he buys the team for $189 million in February 2011, and in his official introductory presser thing at the arena, he says the following words. Starting today, the Buffalo Sabres' reason for existence will be to win a Stanley Cup. So the Sabres made the playoffs a few months later and have never done it again. That was 14 years ago. I was in seventh grade. The playoff drought is still going. Sabres have become the NHL's just fucking doormat. And they play in like the number one most popular hockey market in America. Like we go crazy for hockey anything here. So why? It's pretty obvious to draw a line to the ownership. It's a little bit more complicated than that. You could write like multiple nonfiction books about the history of the Sabres since 2011. So I can't really be comprehensive here. But like as quickly as possible, yeah, Terry's a bad owner. By all accounts, he's extremely cheap. He likes yes men. He's meddlesome and absentee at the same time, because in 2014 he bought the Sabres, and being an NFL owner is a lot cooler than being an NHL owner. So he's mostly content to chill on his super yacht down in Boca. So in terms of hockey stuff, moving away from the fracking asshole, every coaching hire they've made is the bad one. To kind of speak Phantom Island language a little bit, the Sabres have tried every kind of hire. They've done nostalgia hires. They brought back Ted Nolan and Lindy Ruff and Phil Housley. They've brought in retreads like Dan and Bielsma. They've made galaxy brain hires like Ralph Kruger, and they've promoted the interim in Don Granato. That was not at all in chronological order, but yeah, so they've done all the kinds of hires, and they've all failed spectacularly. The current GM, Kevin Adams, is a Pegula yes man who's gotten to hire several coaches, even though he's really not shown anything as a GM, but his job is presumed safe because Terry likes him. On the ice, the players on the ice. I would say that most of the failure of this era can be traced back to the failed tank for Connor McDavid in 2014. The Sabres tanked hard, traded all of their core that made a hard push for a cup in the late aughts, and then lose the lottery and end up with Jack Eichel, who is undeniably a very good hockey player, but is terrible in the locker room and is a like total failure as a captain. Being a captain in hockey is a very big deal. So the Sabres have kind of routinely ended up with talented players like Eichel or Sam Reinhart, who end up demanding out and flourish elsewhere. Sam Reinhart's won multiple Stanley Cups in Florida. The current roster and coaching staff churn means that like great individual players like Tage Thompson or Rasmus Dahlin don't really matter, because there's no team cohesion or identity kind of. Also, they haven't figured out goalies since Ryan Miller left. Fucking assholes. On a macro level, the Sabres have been hurt by NHL realignment also. The Atlantic division they got slotted into in 2013 includes the Leafs, the Bruins, the Lightning, and the Panthers. So they're always playing against better, more stable and accomplished teams. All of this has led to a just truly toxic fan environment. Buffalo's a hockey-starved market, and after 15 years of this, people are just really pissed. I honestly can't even begin to communicate to you how huge the Sabres teams were in this town in 06-07. I was a kid. They felt bigger and more important to the town than the like Josh Allen Bills do now, straight up. That might be nostalgia talking, I don't know. But these days, the arena's empty most nights, and fans who loved them, including me, we just aren't engaged anymore. So I know this was really long and rambly, and not even fully comprehensive. Please, Cerber, chop it up however you want. But this feels like a good summary of the dire situation that the first team that I ever loved is in. This is a like Pittsburgh Pirates level bad situation. And we had some optimism in like 2022, but now there's no end in sight over here. Terry Pegula should be in prison.
Thank you to Victoria. Please buy one of the boys. We'll plug it again, because she I feel like she did some labor on this episode. Like, that was comprehensive. Yeah. I think it was off the rip, but that's what I wanted. I wanted someone from a fan base that has an encyclopedic knowledge of pain to describe that. One addendum or editorial, not I would say correction.
A thing that changed in between this message coming in and our recording.
On December 15th, the Buffalo Sabres fired general manager Kevin Adams after 5+ seasons, replacing him with longtime NHL executive, watch me kill this name.
That's fine.
Yarmo Kekulean?
Be confident.
Kekulean!
There we go. Great.
When you said be confident, that's going to end up being a white Southern guy with doing like what sounds like a bad, racially insensitive bit. I don't know what that person's ethnicity is. Kekulean?
That's fine.
I don't know.
We're doing our best.
Since Victoria included the quote from Pegula upon purchase, I just want to add this one. This is his quote on December 15th. We are not where we need to be as an organization, and we are moving forward with new leadership within our hockey operations department. We are dedicated to building an organization that is competitive year after year, and we have fallen short of that expectation. By the way, Kekulean is Finnish. Let me just pull away from the mic for a second.
Okay.
No shit! God damn. This is brutal.
Yeah.
In my quest to understand and like cope with my own sports misery as a fan, I can't stop thinking about the Buffalo Sabres, Ryan. And the graph was a visual representation of something that I haven't really ever experienced, which is a team that just makes sense doing successful things for a long, long time, decades and decades, enough for multiple generations in Western New York to grow up, again, prone to playing a sport because there's ice everywhere.
Yeah.
And receiving positive ROI, like I like to say all the time, about fandom. And then, oh my God, does it get just absolutely decimated?
There's also a little bit here that I think the Sabres, especially when the Sabres are good, play into Western New York's thing about, like, we're not Boston. We're not New York City. And the ability to be like, fuck the Rangers, fuck the Bruins. Like, we have our own thing and it's cool and good. Like,
yep.
I think hockey really plays well for that purpose. Like, obviously you get that with the Bills and the Patriots, but like, who, I mean, you're better than the Jets. Cool. Everyone's better than the Jets. Not the Falcons. The Falcons are not better than the Jets. I know they lost them. Sorry.
I am not going to distract myself with the Falcons comment. There was a Medium post by a writer named Greg Filou in 2021. So the data is almost certainly out of, like, I'm sure this isn't exactly the same.
2021 is the bottom for whatever it's worth, but okay. Go ahead.
Well, it's not necessarily about the Sabres. It's just about where do hockey players come from.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
There is essentially a triangle, okay, of North American players.
Yep.
So if you are coming from Canada or the United States, you come from a pretty tight triangle, which if you know the area I'm about to describe, you realize how tight the triangle is. And it's if you were to draw, create 3 points on a map of Buffalo, Detroit, and Toronto, and then triangulate those three.
Yeah.
It is 1 in 5 NHL players come from the triangulation, the Great Lakes Caliphate, if you will, of Toronto, Detroit, and Buffalo. It's, for whatever reason, I think it's maybe it's the stereotype perception I have of Buffalo. I visited Buffalo 3 or 4 times now on this summer family road trip that we do to upstate New York. It's always the opposite of the mind's eye of like snowy Buffalo. It's a very lovely place. The thing that I have learned about Western New York, and I would maybe even lump Cleveland and Erie and that whole region is like they are Southern or like proper Midwestern level nice. And then they catch this limbo sort of vibe of like, oh, well, you guys are like Boston sports fans or New York sports. They're definitely not. They're not like Pittsburgh either. Like, it's all very kind, nice people. And then Buffalo just seems to march through hell. Now, this is where I compound it and talk about the Bills for a second, but one weird-ass piece of trivia. So at one point, Adelphia is the first corporate sponsor to name the NFL stadium in Nashville. It is now Nissan Stadium, where the Tennessee Titans start playing after they're the Tennessee Oilers in the limbo year. We've done an episode on this.
Yep.
So Adelphia Coliseum. Adelphia is owned by at the time, the Buffalo Sabres owner. And then they named the Tennessee Coliseum the same time that the Music City Miracle against the Buffalo Bills occurs.
That's mean.
It's
That's
so very weird. Mean. It's so weird.
Sure.
So the Music City Miracle is this tiny piece of history, I think, in the overall sports lore because the Titans don't really command much mind share.
It's good for clip shows and things.
Yeah, they don't
craziest command, like, NFL yeah, endings, I mean, things like
we,
that.
We joke all the time, like people forget the Titans exist.
I will say we're not going to do a Titans episode. What Victoria was talking about of the like mid-aughts, the hold the mid-aughts Sabres had over the city.
Mm-hmm.
My wife is from Nashville, we've talked about before. And that is what she was in high school when the Titans went to the Super Bowl. And that is how she describes how it felt with those Eddie George teams.
Yeah,
you
Steve,
know?
McNair, Steve McNair, yeah, Kevin like, Dice and Frank
yeah,
Wycheck.
Like that is the similar sort of like feeling that it had here. I would not, and maybe I'm just a hater, I would not say that is the feeling you get about the Titans in Nashville these days.
No, and then I'm not trying to draw a parallel, but I guess so too do the people of Buffalo feel about the Sabres now, except for the fact that this just feels like this, again, very specific and bespoke void of something that it's not about should be.
Yeah.
it's about once was.
Could be.
But they were so good. Sure, they were so good.
Yeah.
And this is where the line graph and the illustration caught me dead in my tracks on social. And this is where I'm dwelling, and I'm, there's no way to answer today's question.
Well, what
but
do you
doesn't
wanna,
this feel worse than the idea of, okay, I had a person in an NFL front office DM me out of the blue after the Falcons lost to the Jets.
Yeah.
And he kind of went on this thing. He's like, I know you're a Falcons fan. It's such a tragedy because they should be so much better because. And he gives into this whole thing about like free agents would always go to Atlanta and how it's all set up for success. Great. This is not an Atlanta Falcons episode. I've heard 1,500 reasons why my team should be good and they're not. And so I've sat with that as a sort of framework for sports fan misery.
Right.
What kills me about the Sabres is they are horrible, irrelevant, poorly managed, poorly owned, poorly executed.
They check all the boxes.
And yet they are
I do like the beer sword for what it's worth.
Yeah, no kidding. I do.
The beer sword looks fun.
I definitely need to try that. It's Molson they put in there?
I'm not sure, actually.
That's a high ABV if it's Molson. Molson, by the way, I do. I will grab, somewhat ironically, the six-serve Molson when I'm upstate.
Labatt, it looks
Labatt? Okay, yeah. Well, the ABV is higher in Canadian beer. The Buffalo Sabres were and should be a good hockey team. And it just has stuck in my craw that this has to be in some way more brutal than just cheering for the lovable loser. Because we associate lovable loser with like the Chicago Cubs, right?
Sure.
But if you look through history, like the Cubs have bad seasons.
Yes.
But the Cubs are defined as lovable losers because of this really bizarre relationship with the postseason.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
I'm glossing over. I'm like compressing 90 odd years into, you know, a couple sentences. We don't look at sports fandom and pain like this because it's uncomfortable to do it. Because if we were to make this episode about why are the Sabres bad, well, that's already been answered. Yeah. It's horrific ownership. Right. And the second uncomfortable, and it's hard to rail against that. Do you boycott? Do you get mad? I go through this as a sports fan sometimes where I'm like, I'll just pack all my shit up. I'm not going to wear in public. I'm not going to buy anything else. I'm not going to buy tickets. I'm not going to support this. And then after a while, I think, well, that owner doesn't really own the team. The fans do. Because 99% of owners, they're not even from the town that they bought the team in. And like you were a fan before they knew this was something they wanted in their stupid portfolio. So it's like, why should they keep me from my team and my ownership or my love of the sport? And certainly in the city of Buffalo, that has to be how they feel about hockey. So I dwelled on that for a while, and then I think I came to you and I was like, there have to be some challengers to this type of pain. There have to be franchises across all the major sports where you started off, you built generations of goodwill and fandom and positivity and local affinity for the franchise, and then a force beyond your control destroyed it. There's one other thing I want to talk about real fast. Victoria mentioned it. And I've seen it firsthand. That part of New York is a Bruce Springsteen song in so many ways about economics. No, I'm serious. Like, I read about the history of Rochester and like what the death of Kodak did to Rochester and what went on with like everything from, you know, from like Youngstown up to that northeast, that part of the country where they were once so viable and vibrant as cities. And every economic backbone just broke. And it's rare that this happens with big American pro sports franchises. The Sabres fell prey to that too. So I want to acknowledge that before we move on. If I was a lifelong Buffalo resident or I was from this part of Western New York and I'm in my mid 40s, but even if I was in my 20s or whatever, if I was alive, I probably would not have seen the good old days. I would have only heard about the good old days economically in that part of the country. So this would make me want to sort of beat my chest more. By the way, everything I'm saying, Ryan, describes the other parts of that triangle with the exception of Toronto, like Detroit, Michigan, Northeast Ohio, where hockey's played. Like all of these hockey playing parts of the United States are also synonymous with an economic downturn in the last two generations or more because factory labor declined, because of the Rust Belt, because of the auto industry, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So getting back to the point at hand, because I feel like I'm building the chip on their shoulder even bigger than they can that possibly carry it. Are there comps? Are there challengers to this crown of what I feel like is such a bespoke pain?
So yes, there are other teams that you can look at and see a similar pattern, but I want to, boy, lawyer as always, there are caveats I think you have to apply to this. So this same Reddit user that we mentioned before, the original piece that he did, the original graph that he made was for the Pittsburgh Pirates. And UgLuck4242 is indeed a Pirates fan. That's what led to this. Now, you can see in that graph, which is also on Reddit, you can see sort of the like initial dip, similar to the Sabres. You can see a big climb. You can see a more of a valley at first, but then you can go to, I don't know, let's call it like 1995, 1994, and you can see the Pirates at that point in time are still comfortably over 500 over the course of the franchise. Now, obviously, this goes, the Pirates go back to the 1880s. So that's one thing that's different here, is we're not talking about franchise that got started in 1971.
That's a lot of history, though.
It is a lot of history.
Are the Pirates, I have no idea. My earliest memory of the Pirates is 91. Suck it, by the way.
What do you want to know about the Pirates?
They were good?
The Pirates won the World Series in 1979 and 1971. They went to the NLCS several years in the 1970s. They won the World Series in 1960.
Okay.
They won in 1925. They won in 1909. Yeah, like there is good history here. And I would say like the 70s history is the kind of history that this is like the tail end of the Roberto Clemente years.
Okay.
Willie Stargell is in here. Like, there are good players in here and good times.
The cocaine 70s were really good at Pittsburgh.
Sure. Now, that said, the Pirates as they exist today are a perfect 10,910 and 10,910. That many wins, that many losses.
Wait, what?
Yes, they're according to Baseball Reference.
Okay.
Their overall record.
Say it again.
10,910 wins, 10,910 losses. I should add that because baseball used to work this way, there are also ties in the annals of.
But they are perfectly 500.
But they are perfectly.
They are sitting on the x-axis.
Yes. Yes.
And their last game of the 2025 season was against the Atlanta Braves.
It was against.
I watched it.
It was against.
And the we Atlanta won. Braves. Atlanta won. And yeah. So Pittsburgh is now perfectly balanced. 500 all time.
That was the game that sent Pittsburgh to 500 all time. A record that they had not had since, I can't find the exact number here, but I'm going to say like 1903.
I dedicate that specifically to the Pittsburgh Pirates TikToker who made a whole video about how hard it was to take public transportation to Atlanta Stadium. You can suck it hard.
So anyway, all right. So this is why I say like there are caveats to it. All right. You're a Pirates fan. You are like our mutual friend and colleague, Alex Kirshner, a Pirates fan. I know roughly how old Alex is. And I know that there's nothing about the 1970s Pirates that he gets to be like, boy, what great times. What a wonderful legacy.
No, I feel like you're born into the idea from your Pittsburgh elders that we should be something that we are not.
Sure. But that is a little different than what Victoria's described.
Yes.
I remember what this was and I experienced it.
Also, I don't know if there is such a thing as Baseball City USA, and this is where hockey's different than all the other sports that we would talk about, where you could culturally feel just as entitled to good football in Pennsylvania as you could in Texas.
Yeah.
Right? So, whereas hockey, we talked about that triangle and the development of the players in the United States. Like, this thing's going to hit harder in Buffalo or Minneapolis or Boston than it's going to in Phoenix or Houston or something like that.
That's probably right, yes.
So, I'm going to give the advantage to the Sabres here.
Okay, that's fine. I guess. But
also,
I
own a Sid Bream jersey. I am not an impartial judge.
I guess part of the complicating factor here with all the teams we're going to discuss, and really all teams, is like, how much does the past matter to you, both in terms of past failure and past success? Like, do you look at this and say, I'm a Pirates fan, and that sucks because I know we used to be good. I know the 90s were a thing. And
right.
Like that lingers as a memory or sort of a a reminder of what could be? Or are you a Pirates fan and you're like, this sucks because we've been bad for a long time? Like,
a generational experience, I think, has is probably the key factor here.
Sure.
I'm going to bring up another Alex that we used to work with, a guy named Alex Rubenstein at Secret Base.
Yeah.
I got into arguments with him, which, let me tell you, that's a special experience.
Set aside time if you're going to do it. Don't think I'm going to have a 10-minute argument with Alex Rubenstein about sports.
His quote-unquote, he claimed to be a quote-unquote miserable San Francisco 49ers fan.
Mm-hmm.
That's like his number one team. Everybody has a number one team, I'm convinced. I know everyone says like, oh, I'm from Boston, I love them all. Like, no, you got one team, I think. Everybody really has one team. And his one team was San Francisco 49ers.
Yes.
And because I am about a decade older than Alex Rubenstein, I was like, no, you don't get to be miserable. Because I lived through this, the old NFC West, losing to the 49ers 49-7 twice a season.
Sure.
Watching the 49ers go to the playoffs every year, watching the 49ers beat
Joe Montana become Steve Young.
Like, Joe Montana, yeah, like I'm
you're on the tail
barely end. Old yeah, enough sure. for Joe Montana. I'm certainly old enough for Steve Young. Yeah. I remember all this. I remember beating the Steve Mariucci head coached 49ers in the divisional round of the NFC playoffs the year that the Falcons were at the Super Bowl in 98.
You watched Jerry Rice fuck up your team so many times.
Good Lord, yes.
So many times.
So my argument to Alex was like, no, you don't get to be miserable because I love that I get to determine people's emotions. And Alex looked at me and I realized, I think he's like 12 years younger than me. And he was like, I have nothing. That means nothing to me.
Right.
I'm going to throw you a curveball real fast.
Okay.
Are we describing some hypothetical Gen Z or Gen Alpha Chicago Bulls fan right now?
Oh, yeah. I think that's entirely possible.
Wow.
Sure. Yeah. And I think the flip side of it, and maybe this, I think like the New England Patriots are a good example to me. Because if you grew up in Boston, the Celtics had a legacy. Like you
Definitely,
understood
yeah.
what they were trying to get back to.
Yep.
The Patriots were a dog-ass team for a long
Forever.
Time.
Yeah.
Like, they were not only were they a dog-ass team, they were not a relevant team. They were not a team on anybody's radar.
No.
In a lot of ways. And so, I think, it's even different than the way we talk about Alabama. Like, if you're an Alabama fan who's under the age of 30, your reference point, just based on what you've watched, I'm not saying Alabama fans don't know their history, but just, like, your lived experience is inconsistent with what Alabama has been for a long time.
Yeah.
But by the same token, if you are an Alabama fan who's in your 60s or older, there is consistency with what you've seen and what you saw with Bear Bryant or what you heard about with Bear Bryant. So,
right.
like, I say that because the Pirates are tricky because if you look through, like, the best seasons they've had, you can find 2015, they won 98 games. Did they get out of did they do anything playoffs? No, they didn't. But still, like, great season. And other than that, like the 91-92 seasons, those are 95 wins plus, and everything else is like pretty much from the 70s or the early 1900s. So what makes it tricky for purposes of this graph is everything that got you up mm-hmm. that made the peak feels like a different team entirely, or in some cases a different sport entirely. Like, we're obviously talking about some eras of baseball where free agency wasn't a thing, where the league was smaller, where, you know, this is where it becomes very tricky. So,
okay, but
yeah,
back to the Sabres for a second.
Yeah.
There's that 2011 peak, and now we're in 2025 going into 2026.
Mm-hmm.
That's a decade and change for a human being to experience total collapse.
Yeah.
I assume some of these teams that you're putting up as potential sort of Sabres-esque misery index contenders, I guess. I don't know.
Sure.
Their decline might be steadier, which would then push them into this generational gapping that we're talking about, where it's like, I heard.
Yeah.
It, like, again, to go back to Chicago, there's a lot of folks, maybe all of the millennials and younger, mm-hmm. who are like, well, I heard about the Super Bowl shuffle.
Right.
But, okay. like, I don't know shit about a good Bears team.
Sure. I mean, this year the Bears are pretty decent, even though I don't think Bears
the playoffs have not started as we record this. Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and future-proof this because Ryan just said Chicago is good in the NFL.
I think the Islanders are an interesting comparison because, similarly, like, the Islanders start out they have a couple of like really rough years. But then by the time you get into really like the late 70s, this is a good hockey team. This is like a team that consistently wins. They have the, you know, this streak of, I'm trying to remember exactly. It's four Stanley Cups.
Yes.
From 1980.
Children are like, being conceived right at Nassau Coliseum, according to the internet meme.
Right. So like, that's a sort of like unreal level of accomplishment that I think even the most optimistic Islanders fan is like, I don't expect us to be that, to do that again.
I would love if there's a person out there who knows NHL as well as like the higher end of college football. Mm-hmm. My interpretation of the Islanders run was, do you remember when like weird shit would happen in the ACC in the 2000s where like Wake Forest would win the league?
Sure.
And it was because like, man, Florida State and Clemson and Miami and Virginia Tech, none of them have their shit together.
Yeah.
My interpretation of that period of time where the Isles are just killing everybody, mm-hmm. was it more because there were a bunch of other stalwarts that couldn't get their shit together?
I mean,
if you're out there, hockey slash college football expert, let me know in the comments.
The 82-83 Islanders won 42 games and lost 26. That's not that you don't look at that and be like, that's what a dominant team. But
is this Eli Manning giant shit?
I'm not gonna do that. I'm not gonna bring him into this. That's unnecessary.
Anyway, I don't know. I know I'm not even doing bits here. I'm just genuinely curious.
The Islanders though have had, if you look at their win arc, it is more of a plane coming to a gentle lower cruising altitude. The Islanders have not crashed below 500 through when I looked, they were at about 515. All-time winning percentage.
Do you know any Islanders fans?
I know some online, yeah.
I don't know any in real life because I've never had my car stereo stolen. Okay. So.
Well,
shout out to Long Island.
So I think the Islanders are an interesting comparison, but probably not the right one. Now,
you can also make that joke for the Devils.
The flip side is that what also makes this tricky is that you have some teams, like, all right, right now to use points percentage as a different measure, because points percentage sort of more gets at to like the changes in overtime rules and overtime losses and this, that, and the other. The Vancouver Canucks are the worst, I would say, non-modern expansion team when it comes to that. They are at 494. Columbus and Seattle are below them. Chicago Blackhawks are just barely above them. Chicago Blackhawks have been in existence since 1926. So that's where it becomes hard to say, like, how much is history a thing that matters to you or not?
So it feels like the argument you're building here, and boy, it sure is enlightening to start a two-person company with someone who went to law school and someone who didn't, because I could just feel you building your case here.
We're just having a fun conversation.
Is that the relative youth of the Sabres franchise has actually informed my misery sort of like hyperbole more than I realize.
So let's do this to give you a frame of reference. Let's take the Las Vegas, formerly Oakland, formerly LA Raiders. I'm only going to use 1970 on when the NFL merger happens. But frankly, if I went back to... I think the Raiders get started in the early 60s. They're not one of those teams that, like, harkens back to nobody wore face masks and footballs were square or something like that.
My first memory is that I knew – well, my first memory is hearing John Madden call games and then my dad being like, he coached the Raiders too and won a Super Bowl.
Right. The Raiders were exceptionally good at the start of
– the merger?
The merger.
Okay.
Like – this is back when it's a 14-game season, but from 1972 through, let's say, 1985, they have, and one of the, 82 is weird because it's a strike season, so I'll sort of like leave that one to the side. They have one losing season. They went 7-9 in 1981, and there are a bunch of, there's a 13-1 year in here. There's a 12-2 season in here. There are a couple of 11-win seasons. There's like... this was a inarguably very successful team. Not necessarily piling up Super Bowls and Super Bowl, although they did win some. But, you know, had that same sort of like, boop, 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 right to the top.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, their drop, I think, feels a little bit more like the Sabres. Now, NFL is trickier because the shorter season. So you can only hurt your own. There's only right, so, right, you know, right. Like in baseball, you can lose 100 games. It's yeah. rare, but you can. And you can really, like,
yeah.
take an axe to yeah. your franchise. In football,
yeah.
like, the Raiders have had, you know, in 2014, they went 3-13. Problem is, you don't need to do that well over the next couple of years to sort of, like, erase that. But that said, this is a franchise that has certainly met that. Okay. Now, so the question is, do you feel bad for Raiders fans in the same way you feel bad for Sabres fans? For rooting for this team that has this legacy? I mean,
okay.
They went to the Super Bowl in 2002. You know, there are similarities.
Standing on 10 toes as an Atlanta Falcons fan, that Raiders Super Bowl participation trophy maybe hurts pretty bad.
Okay.
Like, only because of the famous Bill Callahan, John Gruden kerfluffle.
Okay.
That the Bucks literally knew their first 15 but like, plays.
You know, that the Raiders were playing, have played, had a stretch where they were a playoff team and a meaningful playoff team.
Okay. I don't instantly feel the same sympathy.
Okay.
I feel a very different and bespoke sympathy for Raiders fans because of, you know what's weird is that it's circling back around as I'm forming the sentence to mm-hmm. go back to Buffalo. With one difference.
Okay.
If I meet a Raiders fan, man, they are a fan.
Sure.
Like what's even crazier and unique to the Raiders is that most Raiders fans I've met are willing to carry their fandom to a different city. That alone is amazing.
Yeah.
Las Vegas, Oakland, Los Angeles. Like, that is mind-blowing. I truly believe if you moved the Raiders to London or moved the Raiders to Sao Paulo or Mexico City, yeah. I think most fans wouldn't skip a beat.
Okay, that's fair.
That's a national fan base, and they are 110% just as dedicated. Like, they are a – you can finish up a 2-win Raiders season,
mm-hmm.
heading into a 6-win Raiders season,
mm-hmm.
which will then lead to a 4-win Raiders season. And every one of those off seasons, those fans are buying jerseys,
yeah,
and they're locked in and they're in belief.
Yeah.
And it reminds me the most of the fan base I wish I was in the Falcons is the Bills. Because there is a correlation or the sort of the pain signature is similar of okay. the four Super Bowl losses yeah. and 28-3. And the Bills have redefined themselves as a fan base. And then we'll take it back to Buffalo for a second. I know they're good right now.
Yes.
And they drafted Josh Allen. But I also know the history of the Bills, which is after those four Super Bowls, they fall into a decade plus of disrepair, mismanagement, and just losing seasons.
Oh, yeah.
And it's actually in that time, it's between the four Super Bowl losses and really now the Josh Allen draft class on.
A 16-year
yeah.
playoff absence, yes. which in the NFL is
which
like
is which by the way, wild. that's the Patriots ascension.
100%.
The Patriots come yes. to just feast on a terrible AFC East.
The Jets were making the playoffs in yeah. this stretch at the same time. Like,
but during that during that time,
yeah.
the Bills as a fan base become known nationally for Bills Mafia.
Sure.
Ironic embrace of the 90s Zubaz.
Yeah.
Going through tables mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. ECW wrestlers. And this general unkillable, obnoxious positivity, essentially. It's almost like a form okay. of accepted fellowship. We are Bills fans, and the outcome is irrelevant. And what I've learned as raising a kid... And you heard this the other night from my wife off mic. We were having dinner with our spouses.
Yeah.
Was my wife complaining to you that when the Falcons lost to the Jets this year, one of my sons laid on the floor and cried because he was so embarrassed and hurt and angry. And the reason I talk about the Bills a lot is like, well, I think Bills fans are unkillable at this point. And I think they find joy outside of the results, and which is something as a fan. And someone who's been through a lot of therapy, I got to figure that out as a fan. You can't base it all on the results. If it's the Super Bowl, I get it. But like day in, day out, week in, week out, if you're sure. showing up at a stadium and your entire summation of the day was we lost, so everything sucked. When you're tailgating, when you're spending money, when you're traveling.
Yeah.
The bills are different, man.
Okay.
And that makes me not feel as bad. So, but in the same town, mm-hmm. in the same people, it's there is no Venn diagram. It's two circles that make one. Are the Buffalo Sabres.
So I mostly agree with that sentiment. I will say I think one of the distinctions between them, especially now, is that Josh Allen is incredibly fun to watch. And even if the Bills aren't making it to the Super Bowl or don't have a defense that can like really back him up or you know, can't figure out what to do at the receiver position.
Right.
I think there is probably an awareness.
They have
and
Dawson
I don't think
Knox?
Is,
what are you talking about?
I don't think they would argue.
Well, I really broke you on that one.
I guess what I'm saying is that there is something a little different when you get to watch a singular talent and you sort of get to enjoy that for what it is.
Okay.
I think that that cushions, which is something to go
but
back to.
But they didn't build that. They didn't build this brand that I'm talking about during the job. That was ready for Josh Allen.
I understand.
They built that during Nathan Peterman.
Yes, but Josh Allen fits into it in a lot of ways. Here's this guy who every draft expert was like, he sucks. He's bad. Like, it's a similar, there is a parallel to that of like, well, it doesn't have to be bad just because you say it is.
Okay.
It doesn't have to suck just because you, the expert, say it is. The Raiders, I think, and I think the reason I bring this up with the Raiders is like, who is the last, like, wow, what an all-timer Raider that you got to watch?
Oh, God. I can only think of athletes on the back end of their career.
I mean, I think you can say there are
Brock Bowers.
Yeah, like Brock Bowers is one possibility. I think you could say Max Crosby, kind of. But even then, when it happens with the Raiders are so woebegone that I think a lot of the sentiment surrounding them is like, oh, well, you got to get this guy off there. We can't leave. The Raiders can't waste this guy's career. And I don't think anybody feels that way about Josh Allen.
Okay.
But we're psychoanalyzing.
You're pushing this, so you're pushing an argument back on basically trying to get me to figure out why I have this excess sympathy for the Sabres. I think time is a big part of this.
Sure. That's fair.
And I think it's possible to be alive right now as a Raiders fan and have no concept of good football.
Yeah.
Because that Super Bowl appearance was 2002.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
When I walked into the office this morning, I checked the birth date of the new Washington State head coach, and he was born in 1990. So things that are relative to me and you are sure. Not relative to the other generations.
Sure. The other thing that I think makes a distinction, which helps your argument, frankly, is that Raiders ownership has not changed. Teams moved around plenty.
Boy, has it not.
And a lot has changed. But like, I think there is some degree of if you've been in on the Raiders this long, you understand like the decline of Al Davis. And you understand the shortcomings of Mark Davis.
That's a really delicate way to do
being,
that.
I am so diplomatic. I'm such a nice guy.
Lawyered.
Whereas, if you are a fan of the Sabres and you saw new ownership come... That, I think, is the difference. Is you saw new ownership come in, talk a bunch of we're going to achieve things you never thought possible, and then rip your guts out.
I think it's time. And I think ownership, I think, is maybe the number two. I think time is number one. And the fact that you have someone coming in, who, by the way, also owns the Bills, right?
Yeah.
What the fuck? It's mind-blowing.
Now, here's another quiver in the ownership argument. Washington Commanders. This is similarly a team that they go back longer than the Raiders do. But if we're just looking at the merger on, like, mm-hmm. super successful out of the gate, you know, especially in the 80s. In the 80s, this team was a bunch, like, a terrifying team to play.
I had a black Washington fan back when they were the Redskins say, he's like, look, we're well aware of the dog whistle racism that was imbued in this franchise, but we won a lot when the racist was there. Like, there's a lot of give and take.
That explains a lot about where we are right now.
Yeah,
nationally.
It does.
Anyway,
it does.
This is a team that I think this is also a frustrating team because I wouldn't say their descent has been as dramatic. Like, they're still over 500 as a franchise, but for a while there, like, at least in the merger NFL, they had a record as high as like nearly 650 in 1987. Like, this was, you would look at that and you would say, like, not only is this a successful franchise, it's one of the most successful franchises in the
model
league.
Model yes. franchise.
Yes. And where the degree to which they dropped under Snyder, but they also did that thing where I'm looking at the list here and it's like there's so many 6-10, 7-9, 8-8. It's that it's the bad that actually kills you, where it never bottoms out, and you always think it's why for so many years Washington was the offseason champion, because they would look, I think they would look at themselves and say, like, well, we're just a couple pieces. If we can just one more Albert Haynesworth, that's all we, you know? And I think that creates a sort of like miserable death. I think it's a little bit more like the Falcons, frankly, where you're sort of like caught in limbo of like, man, we're not getting better, but we're also not terrible. And so I'm just stuck watching this team that I know can play with most teams in the league and isn't going to do shit.
Whereas the Sabres are terrible.
Whereas the Sabres are just bad. Whereas the Raiders are just bad.
Category two here, I think the comp fits perfectly for the Washington Commanders, Redskins saga, whatever, because there is a really specific turn when ownership changes, which is similar to the Sabres. Do I feel bad for that franchise? No,
sure.
I do not. I had to grow up around Hoggettes. And if you know what a Hoggette is, you will understand why I have zero sympathy for that fan base.
There is one more baseball comp I can pull here, and I almost don't think it works, but I'll use it anyway. Kansas City Royals come into existence in 1969, and they take a little while to find their footing. But by 1977, their eighth year in existence, they go 102-60. They won 90 games the year before that, 91 the year before that, 92 the year after this, like, became a good franchise pretty quickly. And since then, with the important exception that they have won a World Series that we saw not that long ago.
It was in between all the Giants World Series.
Right. But that said, so that's the, I believe that's the 2015 World Series, if I have my, it is the 2015 World Series.
Okay.
2015, Royals win 95 games, beat the Mets in the World Series. Very next season, 500. Two seasons after that, 58-104.
God.
This is the collapse I probably wanted to do. The most interesting thing to me about the Royals is not that they have necessarily this legacy of like, oh, Brett Boone, and, you know, we have this thing we should be.
Yeah.
It's that they had this little bubble where they weren't terrible, where it all came together, and then it immediately disappeared. Like, it immediately
disappeared. Where success was the aberration.
Yes, and not even in that, like, Marlins way, where it's like, oh, well, you broke it all up. It just sort of were like,
you bought it and took it apart.
The same thing. Now, without getting too deep into it here, and most of this is because, you know, I'm friends with John Boyce, who's a Royals fan. This is also, there are some Sabres elements of this as well, where, like, a lot of owners wanted to get a hold of the Royals, but probably move them.
Yeah.
Like, it becomes sort of this trade-off of, would you rather see your team stay, or what would you rather see them leave and thrive? I can tell you, to go back to Alex Rubenstein and Supersonics fans, it's not awesome to see your team leave and thrive.
No, I think that would be terrible.
Yeah.
I hope I never experience that. Like, no, that's brutal. The only thing I have close to that is the Winnipeg Jets' second incarnation of the Thrashers. And, like, yeah, I still kind of cheer against the Jets.
So then it becomes like, well, would you rather be a Sabres fan who still has the Sabres, even in this, like, severely mismanaged form?
Yeah.
Or would you rather they leave? That's the hard one. I don't really know
neat.
How to answer that.
You made it bleaker than I could.
Yeah. I do have a couple of NBA comps we can turn to as well. I think they're different in many ways.
We'll do it as a conclusion.
The Washington Wizards, as late as the 1987-88 season, were above 500 as a franchise. They
Shout
currently
out.
Sit at about 441.
Wow. They should go back to the Bullets.
The
NPC police.
The Sacramento Kings had some very good years.
Really?
in the 60s.
Oh, okay.
Is what I was going
so
to say.
So is that the ABA?
I think that's right. Yeah, and I don't... yeah, so... and this is also, like, these are franchises that have moved around, whatever. They have had a pretty steady decline. They're at 457. I don't think these are the same thing. Okay. I don't think... like... and so you bring up the Bulls. The Bulls are an interesting...
the Bulls were not good before Jordan got there.
Sure. Because if you look, like...
local sports writer finally watched The Last Dance last year, and now he's an NBA expert.
So if you look at, like, where do you think the Bulls rank in terms of all-time winning percentage in the NBA?
I don't think it's that high, because they're the Bulls as a franchise are essentially like an afterthought, a nonsense doormat in a major city until Mike gets there.
More or less, yes.
Yeah.
13th. They're between the Nuggets and the Mavericks. They're just over 500.
I probably would have guessed maybe 10th at the highest.
Sure.
Because he does spend the better part of a decade. I mean, like, wasn't the 98 year where they lost like some ridiculously low amount of games?
Oh, that's the 62, 63
right. Like I'm saying that has to juke the stats a little.
It helps, certainly. Like, but yeah, to your point. So that's why the Bulls don't fit this graph, because for so long they were so bad. The Bucks are another, like, the Bucks are not, if you're just looking at this graph and sort of saying who's, the Bucks have the worst winning percentage in the NFL as a franchise. They're 4-12. They're worse than the Cardinals. They're worse than the Jaguars. They're worse than the Jets. They're significantly worse than your Atlanta Falcons. But most of that is because they were a terrible expansion team. It took them forever to get going. And, like, I don't know. As somebody who used to be a Bucks fan, I don't find...
what?
What? You knew this.
I did not.
I lived in Tampa growing up. I was a Bucks... yeah.
No.
Oh, you thought I meant the Pirates?
No. I thought you meant the Milwaukee Bucks.
Oh, the Milwaukee Bucks. I'm sorry. I jumped back to the NFL.
Okay.
The Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
We need to clarify.
I apologize.
I was like, man, that is...
I meant the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. I didn't mean...
that was an affectation, being like, I now ride with the Milwaukee Bucks.
I didn't mean the Milwaukee Bucks. I didn't mean the Pittsburgh Pirates. I was
still thinking about Giannis. Sorry.
Anybody else pick Bucks related? Yeah, so the Bucks
have...
yes,
you grew up on the Tampa Bay Bucks.
Yes.
Mike Allstott, et cetera.
But at the same time, like... most of, like, the reason their curve isn't very good is because they never got up the mountain to begin with.
Right.
So I guess this goes back to the question of, like, were I a Bucks fan now, or when I was a Bucks fan as a teen, should I care about that? Like, should I care about, like, how bad the 1976 Bucks were? And into the 90s, to be clear. Like, Trent Dilfer sucked on those teams.
No, because I think, what's the axiom? Winning cures all.
Yes, right.
Right, but it does not look like the Buffalo Sabres are going to be winning anytime soon.
So that's the question I want to flip back on you.
Okay.
Is it worse to be a Sabres fan right now because, like, the Sabres are not winning right now? They don't look like they're on a path to become... a highly competitive team.
Right.
Is that worse because of their history? Yes or no?
Yes.
And why is it worse to have that experience for a team that you've seen do well versus one that you've always seen just struggle?
Well, I think it's just as simple as you can understand the possibility. There's precedent, there's history. There was a functionality here.
So you think a Jets fan is more just like, these nerve endings don't work? Again, New York Jets, not other Jets.
Yeah, and the Jets are good comp too, because my God, what miserable 25-year-old Jets fan gives two fucks about Joe Namath, honestly?
Sure.
Yeah, I think it's the idea of the thing that got me the most,
yeah,
to take this home, was the idea of having something you felt like you deserved as a fan base by regionality,
mm-hmm,
by, you know, that again, hockey is such a specific thing to hockey, that sort of geographic identity,
mm-hmm,
the success basically out of the chute, right? You stumble a little bit and then, wow, they take off. And then to have that fall apart by the measure of a lifetime of a sports franchise, incredibly short order. I think we're, what I say, 2011, so 14 years. to have it fall apart. So, and then here's the most important descriptor. That is a precipitous drop.
Yeah.
They're really, it's as if the Brady Belichick Patriots were to end with 10 or 12 2-win seasons in a row.
Not happening, unfortunately. But,
unfortunately not, no.
To go back to the Chicago Bulls, because on this feed we did a We're Not All Like This very early in the launch of Phantom Island about the Bulls. I think one of the tricky things about the time argument is that for some people, maybe people our age or around our age, is it's less about I've seen this and I know it can be this way. Because if you're a Bulls fan, I think you understand that, like, Michael Jordans are not easy to find.
No.
I think it is more about, oh, my kids or young people I work with or whatever, people who, like, know about this thing but didn't see it, it stops being real in a weird way.
Yeah,
it stops
definitely.
Being a thing that, like, means anything.
Yes, that's the heart of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, it's maybe this weird fear or anxiety that the failures of the present are eroding the past in some way. Like, they're taking away yes. from what it was because...
Oh, I'm going to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Finish your thought.
No, because, well, like, look, the experience you're having with your son, being a Falcons fan.
Yeah.
I say this with love for you and him, is consistent over time.
Yes.
Like, he is having the Falcons experience you had.
They're in the second longest drought. I think it's coming on close to the first in the modern era of a postseason drought.
I'm missing the playoffs.
Yeah, yeah.
If you, Stephen Godfrey, were a Bulls fan, raising a Bulls fan, you would be having incongruous experiences.
Correct.
And I think that would be the hard thing of knowing that, like, I got to enjoy this way, and what you're having is so different and so bad.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you bring this up, because now that you've phrased it this way, it doesn't suddenly feel as harrowing as cheering for a team, because people ask me all the time, why do you invest in this? There is zero precedent for this to work. It is convincing everyone you can fly and jumping off of a two-story building and falling every single time. Whereas in that sort of, like, happy hour, bar talk, sports fan kind of frequency, I think you could still get mileage out of, like, oh man, you know, I grew up, my dad was such a big Niners fan, and he told me about Montana and Young and all that. Like, I just got addicted to that idea. By the way, like, this is, I'm also describing now probably two generations of Cowboys fans.
Yeah, we can't get into the Cowboys of this right now,
right?
Because that would add another half hour.
We've wandered astray, but for whatever reason, I will say this. We can't answer the question, and I knew we couldn't.
Yeah.
But there is something that feels so painful. If I'm a Buffalo Sabres fan, it's that combination of poor ownership and the speed and alacrity with which the thing fell apart.
Deteriorated, yeah.
And that feels like a pain I hope I never know as a fan, and a pain that I offer empathy towards.
Okay, that's how wrong we were. And I will say, I know I'm the one who's always apologizing and always sort of like saying, gosh, sorry the house is such a mess. I think the core of the discussion still holds up. Like, the idea that, you know, we're doing that very Stephen Godfrey thing of, what is the worst form of fan pain? Is it to be good and then bad? Is it to be always bad? Is it to get close but not quite? In re-listening to the episode, realizing that the Sabres have gotten good, I think, like, the core of it still works.
I think it's fine. I think you're ignoring business avenues and opportunities. Send us a significant. How much is one Bitcoin worth?
It's like a lot, that, right? Do you want the answer now or the answer? But by the time this episode comes out, the answer could have changed by
$1,000. All right, let's go back to unmarked bills. Non-sequential. Okay. I'm not a chump.
Yes.
All right. Okay. And I am going to put the marker on them. I know how that is. Pay us, we'll say something sucks, and then it'll magically unsuck, and they'll be like, oh, look at those middle-aged podcasters. This is a cash business.
The Sabres, after we recorded this episode, they were on the start of this winning streak. They went on a 10-game win streak, which they haven't done since 2018, And only two other teams, as of this recording, have done this season. The Lightning and the Avalanche. Like, it's absurd how much the Sabres felt the energy in our universe and said, fuck you, we're good now. Go away.
Yeah.
Don't lump us in with the Pirates sounds and the like Raiders.
Sounds like a Pittsburgh baseball fan needs to be stroking a check right now. I think all of this holds, and I think bad ownership is bad ownership. Now, the one thing that we want to discuss, because
yes,
I think this was the first conversation I had with you when I got back to Nashville, was we were touching base because I was gone for a long time. Coaching convention, national championship, then God forbid I took a vacation, a couple days. And I got back and I was checking in with you and you were like, have you seen what the Buffalo Sabres are doing? And then we discussed that, and I was like, it's fine. I'll shine it. It's fine. Then you were like, yeah, but think about this in the context of the Buffalo Bills. So if anything, it's not like the Pegula magic has left. Magic, maybe curse is probably the better word. It's that apparently we've crossed streams, and now the Buffalo Bills are kind of the recipient to the general dumbfuckery and malfeasance that we talked about in the main episode with the Sabres.
The problem is our magic so powerful that by declaring that, we have now put the Bills on a trajectory where Joe Brady wins the Super Bowl and becomes the greatest coach across all of football.
Oh, no. Oh, wait. No, I thought you were leading me into this thing of like, oh, well, is this like where a genie shows up and they're like, we'll give you $1 million, but somewhere someone dies?
Yeah.
So like, do you think that we were just like, we just inadvertently put the good Buffalo on the Sabres at the expense of the Bills?
We're not actually changing
the net
energy of the universe. We're just moving it to different places. Interesting. Okay. That could be that. Either way, I would probably rather be a Sabres fan than a Pirates fan. Before we go, we got a second bite at this apple. It would be wrong not to give Victoria the same opportunity. So we asked for a follow-up comment. And here we have Victoria explaining a little bit about what exactly the hell happened to the Sabres, with a little bit of Bill's theory at the end as well.
Hello again, Phantom Island. I've been asked to provide a follow-up on the initial voice memo I sent for this episode, which was recorded in early to mid-December, mere days before the very sudden firing of Kevin Adams and the subsequent promotion of Jarmo Kekäläinen to the full-time GM role. I'm recording this in my car, so, like, heads up if it sounds weird. I think I was asked to give a voice memo explaining the Sabres at the funniest possible moment that it could have happened. Because in early December, everything was bleak. The Sabres were never going to be good again. But quite literally, since I recorded that voice memo, the Buffalo Sabres have gone from dead last in the East to comfortably in a playoff spot after their best stretch in team history. From December 9th to January 29th, the Sabres won 20 of 24 games. And they're not just, like, on a heater at the craps table. Like, they aren't winning these games on smoke and mirrors. They're kind of just, like, outplaying everyone they go up against. They're kind of just kicking ass. So, how or why did this happen is a natural question. There are a few things going on. So, the Sabres were dealing with a lot of injuries early in the season. They got a lot of their players healthy, but they did win a lot of these games, missing key contributors like the young Yuri Cooley, Alex Lyon, big free agent signing, and Josh Norris, big trade acquisition, with Lyon specifically being a like very key player for this team, kind of like solidifying the goaltender room, which quality of goaltending play is another reason why they've gotten a lot better. But other than that, you're kind of just seeing like development continue. They've got young guys like Josh Doan and Noah Ostlund are kind of like rounding into form and becoming very viable pro players. But then you also have veteran defensemen like Matias Samuelsson and Bohm Byram kind of playing the best hockey of their professional careers. So a lot of this is just kind of the normal consequence of a long rebuild finally clicking. of a plan coming together, like a good coaching job by Lindy Ruff, but it also, at least partially, is like vibes based. Jarmo Kekalainen isn't the interim GM here, but you can kind of think of it like an interim bounce when you fire a coach in football. And I say that because Kevin Adams built a roster that can clearly win, as evidenced by the fact that they're in a playoff spot now at the Olympic break. And, like, there's no material reason to think that firing a GM would make a hockey team go from being terrible to being a, like, top 5-8 team in the league overnight. But, like, it feels hard to draw another conclusion when it's so dramatic and so sudden. A thought that I've had, maybe, is that if the Sabres kind of stay a playoff contender with the, like, current core intact, that, like, Kevin Adams could be seen as a, like, hockey Sam Hinkie, kind of a guy who's viewed, like, in hindsight as a, like, maverick who did the hard work and built a winner, but who got betrayed before his team could kind of, like, come to fruition before his very own eyes. And I do kind of wonder how it must feel to be Kevin Adams, like, watching this hockey team that he built succeed only after he's gone. Like, you have to imagine that he's proud of it and that he's putting it on his resume, but, like, I don't know. Has to be a very strange feeling. That's the big stuff. Sabres are good now. I do have one last, like, Terry Pegula related thought that will kind of bring this back around to Phantom Island's bread and butter, fired football coaches. I can't prove this in any way, but I am certain that Terry Pegula, seeing what happened when he fired Kevin Adams in December, kind of started to, like, feel, you know, kind of started to, like, feel himself a little bit, you know? So when the Bills lost to the Broncos in the playoffs, Terry was like, I'm feeling myself a little bit. Heat check, fire Sean McDermott. Only Terry, God, and his fucking ChatGPT personal therapist will ever know if this is correct. But I'm like 90% sure the Sabres being good again made Joe Brady my team's head football coach. So I don't know. Nothing good will ever happen. Life's meaningless. Eat Arby's.
Phantom Island is produced by Michael Serber. Our theme song is also called Phantom Island from the album of the same name by King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard. Thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon.